bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody.
The one constant to this show, Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Yobity-yobity-yo. That's a new hot catchphrase. Put that on a patch on a t-shirt.
Going to the trademark office right now. Cafe Press It. Or whatever they do now. I don't know. Gentlemen, so today we had some cool space news, some better news since we've had some disappointing stuff coming out of the Boeing Starliner program. But some good news is today Blue Origin opened up or started their factory in Huntsville, Alabama, which they're going to be making their BE-4 engines, and the other engines are making big engines there, which are going to be powering some of the next generation rockets. So that's pretty exciting. And hiring like 300 people to work in the facility there.
And so these are all still the single stage, not to orbit, but single stage to suborbit.
Well, these engines will actually could be used to power their reusable rockets that Blue Origin's working on. So these are going to go work towards. First, they're selling engines to other rocket companies to use them instead of, let's say, the Russian engines. So the BE-4s will be used for those. And then the BE-4s will actually be used in their, I think the next one they want to do is the new Glenn rocket, which they're building, which will be the one that will be their first orbital class rocket. And I believe these will be the same engines that power that. So that's exciting. And it's nice to see, Blue Origin, making more hardware and getting stuff out there.
That's so great.
Yeah, it's exciting news. We want everybody to succeed because it's like rooting for internet companies in the early 1990s. Like, you want everybody to succeed because it's going to be way bigger than this.
Yeah.
Other news was SpaceX had a launch today, yet another Starlink launch where they put, I think, another 60 satellites into orbit, and that went off this morning. The booster, this would have been their 50th landing if they landed it, but it landed in the ocean and it went for a swim. So,
yeah, I think they said it was a soft landing. It wasn't like a big old disaster, but it looked like their GPS was a little bit confused.
Yeah, sometimes what will happen is that it's not necessarily a GPS issue, but they have the amount of fuel they put in it or for some of the thrusters. When they've missed it before, it's been actually because like the one of the thrusters didn't have any fuel left in it and it couldn't like divert itself to where it was supposed to go. And it just falls, almost there, guys. And you're like, want. But, man, they make so many of those boosters now. It's insane. So.
Yeah, they're like, good riddance. Just, I already have three other ones. Psh, that one's the. Yeah. So what if it was mint in box?
Yeah.
So what is the target for the first generation of Starlink satellites? Like 3,000, 4,000 units?
I think that's the number.
So this takes us to 300, and I believe, depending on where you were, one of these days I want to get up like at crazy in the morning and actually try to catch, that array of all of them just as they deploy. It ends up looking like a bizarre ass, moon brightness line of dots in the sky.
Yeah, and that's what, one of the things that had astronomers concerned is they would go see when the satellites first deploy, they're all close together, as you explained, in that little train, and it's very easy to see. And then they go further out and they deploy and they're harder to see, but when they first launch, they're very visible. And that's one of the reasons why they're frustrating is because SpaceX is saying like, oh, well, eventually they're going to be harder to see, but people go, no, I see it. And it's like, well, they're still in that process. And Musk has said that each generation of satellite, the albedo is going to decrease to the point that they don't want the astronomy community hating them. So they're doing what they can do to figure out how to make them, less prominent. But SpaceX now has more satellites in the sky than any other entity in the world, including like foreign governments.
Wow.
Or U.S. government.
And you can't imagine that they will be in that position forever, right? Like, since they are literally just the conduit to get to space, you would imagine maybe they always will, but maybe there will be other reasons that people are putting up these satellites.
Yeah, you know, it used to be Elon Musk's talking point to girls was, do you ever think about electric cars? Now it's going to be, do you know how many satellites I have? So well, it works. And this was some really cool news that came out last week. It was surprising. Remember how NASA, we talked about how they had let go of William Gerstenmaier. He'd been head of manned spaceflight operations for NASA for years, right? Was sort of a legend of running the human exploration part. And NASA, there had been, I guess, you know, between him and Bolden, there was some sort of disagreement on, you know, as far as like, hey, you know, how, what the pay should be, how NASA should be. And so they let him go. And that was sort of a big controversial sort of deal that, you know, he was let go. But he just got hired. He just, and he was a guy that was going to get hired by, you know, it wasn't hard to imagine somebody wanting to hire him. Do you guys know who hired him?
I do, because somebody texted me about it. But yeah, no, he is now at SpaceX, which certainly bolsters their push to have manned craft, right? Like this is maybe the most important hire to bridge the gap between this is a startup that is great at creating rockets, and this is literally the person that if you were to write down a blue sky dream to bring somebody on to you know, have SpaceX transition to manned flight, he's the guy.
And let me just clarify. I meant to say Bridenstine. Bridenstine and him were the ones that difference, and Bolden was the previous NASA administrator, for those of you kicking count. Sorry, Brian, go ahead.
I am so sorry. Remind me, what was the controversy about him being let go?
Well, he had been an institution forever, and so for shifting him out of, pushing him out of NASA was, you know, considered, was, people were shocked and surprised by this. And the inside was that he had his pace at which he wanted to work it at, and that there, and we don't really know the full reasons why, but the idea was that basically Bridenstine was, you know, trying to make a very nimble, fast moving NASA, and they may have butted heads or whatever, and, you know, and Gerstmeier had a ton of power in there. And so, you know, sometimes that can be hard when you want to change things, when people are going to defer to, like, well, I'm going to defer to this other guy, even though he's your subordinate. Don't know the real reasons, but we knew it was, he had been an institution there as you know, having been involved there for years, but, and well-loved, like that, you know, he had, you got congrats, you know, the head of the Russian space agency has dealt with him for years and, you know, was excited to see he's got a new, you know, where he's ended up now and whatnot. So, I think sounds like a great move on SpaceX, because once they want, because carrying people, it's different than Facebook satellites that blow up and it becomes punchlines, you know? And so I think from the surface, it sounds like it's a great idea.
Boy, that's, you know, that's a really wise distinction, where it's like, we will chuckle at payloads blowing up, but you cannot do that with human payloads.
Yeah. Yep. So, and it signals that SpaceX is taking this very seriously. Took the guy that was the top guy in the world for human spaceflight and managing different programs, who was, some people thought was maybe kind of anti-new space, maybe was more, let's just keep doing it the way we're doing. I don't know his real positions on that. That was the perception of it. And saying, well, we're going to bring him here, and we're going to let him, you know, help us figure out how to make sure that we're really where we need to be.
And I, like, for branding, that's what SpaceX wants. Because if there is a knock on SpaceX, either from their competitors or from skeptics, it is that they go too fast and that they're trying to move this thing at a pace that is unreasonable. And that's why we're going to get dicey safety records. And if this guy was the slow it down partner voice in the room at NASA, then that seems to be a, you know, filling in a at least a public relations issue. It seems like kind of a perfect hire.
That really does, yeah, sort of pose the question, though, of just like, how, if he was not happy at NASA and wanted NASA to slow down, and NASA said, get out of here, Slowy McSlowerson, like, how's that going to be a fit at SpaceX? But hopefully they got him plugged into the right role where, you know, everybody will be happy.
Yeah. Yep. Completely agree. So, all right, you guys ready for a mystery?
Oh, indeed. Hot damn.
All right, first I need you guys to put on your paleontologist detective hats.
Mine's just one of those explorer's hats, only with brass goggles and three extra lenses that I can swap out at any time.
Brian, you're going to need those lenses. It was a great choice.
Good. What about you, Justin? What equipment do you got?
I've got my fedora. Where's the international sign of a paleontologist detective, m'lady?
What about your henchman, Bryce?
Oh, I've got on my thinking invisible cap. Sombrero.
Bryce has a trench coat with pockets filled with all sorts of stuff you guys might need, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
That's right.
Yeah.
We call him the old walking utility belt. Yeah, oh, whoa, you just pulled out a utility belt. That's very useful.
Yeah, my utility belt has utility belt pockets.
Everything else just flatters to the ground. gentlemen, we're going to step inside a cave here. I've got a mystery for you here. Possibly a new species. I'm calling it Spider Dino.
Oh, okay.
Spider Dino.
Yeah, Spider. It's my name. I'm not a official paleontologist.
I mean,
but I tell you, I've watched enough Discovery Channel. I know what's going on.
Look, I mean, who am I to criticize your marketing? But this does sound like a place where they serve flies to hungry spiders at the Spider Dino.
A spider diner?
Yeah.
So you're saying the neon sign out front was a bit much.
Welcome to the Spider Dino. Hi, I'm Flo. What can I help you with?
The doo-wop, I think, is what's maybe misleading people.
I'm very hungry for a melt, though.
Well, follow me into the cave. Follow me into the cave.
Got it. We're following you into the cave.
All right. We're in the cave. We're in the cave. We're in the cave. Everybody here? Here?
Yes.
How come I don't know what that echo? An echo.
What? You also sound very far away. Away.
Yeah. I'm here. All right.
I'm like, all right, guys. So what do you think? What do you think? Explain that.
What am I looking at?
Oh, is it this? Are we showing him this?
Oh, wait. Let me turn on the light.
Okay. Because I was like, this is like some advanced role playing where it's like you don't even have a dungeon master.
Take
my face. I'm making the spooky face with my flashlight.
Take a look over here. Oh.
Now let's look on the ceiling. I'm aiming the light at the ceiling.
At the ceiling. Okay. So there looks to be.
A like chicken foot concert.
Well, reverse. They look like reverse footprints. Footprints extruded outward from the surface.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But they look
like
those.
Like something's trying to claw out of a cocoon of some sort. Like to give you a visual representation of what it appears to be. That there's some kind of three-toed creature that the feet are kind of sticking out.
I mean, to be honest, imagine a chicken walks across soft clay, and then you pour in plaster, and then you peel all of that off, and you have positives is what these would be, because the negative would be the foot impressions in there. So you got like, it looks like a stone positive of chicken footprints, but you're saying that's, when you say
but we're looking the up roof, right now, our neck
it's
is
straight
clean.
Above us?
Straight above us. And those are 200 million old footprints. Those are theropod footprints. Those are dinosaur prints.
Ooh, hold on. I put on my brass goggles and I zoom in. And as I do, I annoyingly say, enhance. And I look closer and I say, gentlemen, is it possible that this... I turn to the rest of the gang and I say, who could tell me about this cave? How is this cave formed?
Well, it's a cave.
I knew it. All right, here's my theory. Caves very often are stone that has something eat away caves out of it. So what if, and sometimes there are different layers of sediment. So what if at one point this was a soft clay that got impressions in it, and then other dirt or matter came in, like maybe a landslide or whatever, formed a new layer. And then over time, because it's two different types of stone, maybe a slightly acidic water washed away the limestone in this very cave where we're standing, and we're left with a stone positive of these dinosaur footprints up above us.
Or it was a big old chicken.
Or a big old chicken.
It could have been a big chicken with very small feet.
Yeah, very tiny feet. So the biggest chicken you could ever imagine, it stepped so hard into the ground above that it left these two footprints.
Actually,
could it be? This would be weird. This I'm gonna say this because I've started to say this, but I know that this is very stupid. But it almost looks like there's like a secondary, like especially on this left footprint, there's almost like a secondary, like ring
two
around it.
Sets of footprints. Bryce, but where was the second chicken when there was only one set of footprints?
Well, that was when the first chicken was carrying you.
I think we've solved the case.
Well, a separate other thing, I'm realizing the problem with this picture is I have no sense of scale. There's nothing in there that I can hook my brain around. How many inches wide? Hold on. I flip through my lenses and go to the ruler lens, and I try to get a sense of how big from back of the foot to the front toe each of those are.
I'm probably like 3 inches or so, or something.
Okay, so it is pretty big. About chicken sized.
Three inches.
So, the article was headlined. The headline for the article was the solved the mystery surrounding dinosaur footprints on a cave ceiling. Apparently, the mystery surrounding dinosaur footprints on a cave ceiling in central Queensland has been solved after more than half a century. For 50 years, this was a mystery. Nobody had a solution. Nobody was sure what it was, according to this article.
Only 50 years?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like a long time to have known about this if these are very old.
I guess people had caves before they even had science.
Yeah, now that I think caves about for it. Quite a while now.
Well, I'm going to explain to you guys. Well, actually, Brian, what we now know was a dinosaur walked across a thing like a clay or something like that, and then there was a sedimentary layer on top of it, and then the layer below it dissolved away, leaving the caves on the footprint.
Yes! I don't think in the entire history of weird things I've ever so perfectly landed a thesis. Standing belly clap from both. Oh, this is the best. Oh! Huzzah! Huzzah!
You've done it, Ryan. You've finally done it. Took us 10 years to nail one of these. Like, from the very, very the jump you had this one. It took us a decade to do it, but we finally got there. Folks, that's it. Thank you for listening to Weird Things. We'll never do it again.
Oh, man.
I'm going to ask you a question, Ryan. Did your experience in skepticism and stuff and seeing how people would look at reversed images like craters and think they're like the knowing when you see the thing it could be inverse outvert, you know
what it really was my experience in magic making prosthetics because for the skewer through your tongue trick I had to take an alginate impression of a tongue and then create a stone positive. And then from that, you make a silicone mold. And then in that, you put gelatin or whatever. And that is going back, 15? Oh, geez, I'm old. 20 years. And then again, we've covered it a few times in various stuff on like Mono Rogue. So I think I wish I could attribute it to any kind of deductive reasoning, but instead it's just purely, that looks like that thing I've seen several times.
I want to be the scientist there with Brian next to me, like, oh, this is a guy, he does YouTube videos, you know, magic videos and stuff. Well, over here we have a mystery we haven't solved for 50 years. How did the footprints end up on the ceiling?
What's funny is I was already happy just that I solved a weird things bit. It didn't occur to me that this has been puzzling scientists for 50 years.
According to the article, this is in it's fizz.org, which apparently had been a big mystery, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Congrats, sir.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we all celebrate this victory, this once in a lifetime opportunity by heading on over to support the show.
Indeed, Brian. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this very podcast. Head on over there right now. Give us a little bit of scratch, you know, whatever you got in your pocket right now. And folks, you can help make sure that this show continues to run each and every week. Get a custom RSS feed. Make sure that you get these episodes earlier than anybody else. It's so easy. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah. And we can solve other mysteries. We could get a van. We could go out there and, you know, make things happen. There has been a new and our Beetlejuice, Beetlegeist update. As far as, is it going to go Nova, which understand this is going to be a continuing series we're going to do and update you on the condition of it going Nova, which means it could take 100,000 years. But in the last like week or so, there have been some more, apparently been some more fluctuations on it and has some people excited like, ooh, maybe we're going to see something. Maybe we're going to see this thing, you know, go Nova.
Do we know what percentage of difference we've seen over the last few years with, I mean, it looks like, I don't know, to just squint at it from December to January, I mean, maybe a 40% increase a decrease on there. I mean, that's really a huge difference. And as a matter of fact, I got mixed up and thought that Rigel was Beetlejuice when I was looking at Orion the other day, just because Rigel is so much brighter than Beetlejuice. I remember Brant was asking, hey, which one is that one? I was like, oh, that's got to be Beetlejuice because that's so, so bright. And then later I double checked and it's like, nope, Beetlejuice is the shoulder, not the foot. And you could see with the naked eye how much dimmer it is.
Yeah, it's like 36% of its brightness.
That's so crazy. That's massive.
Yeah.
The question in the chat is, how safe are we? And I believe everything I've read has indicated that it could go full on supernova and we would be far away and just get a spectacular view.
Technically, we will be safer because there will be more light at night to drive by. Slightly more light at night once it goes nova for us to drive by. But yeah, it's not one of those colossal super ones that like, you know, send out so much radiation that it, you know, kills off half the things on the planet.
Or a gamma burst that's just going to sterilize us like could happen with a much closer star.
Yeah, so it'll be a lot more brightness in the sky, and apparently if it goes, then, you know, we'll have a little more light at night.
I think we could all use a little more light in our lives. Thank you, Beetlegeist.
Once it goes. But yeah.
When it goes, I believe in it. Go supernova. Live your dream.
And I apologize. Did we do a totally unrelated now? Did we do the show the video of the up-res version of the train pulling into the station?
No, you're talking about the original, the black and white film that had people panicked in the audience because they had never seen a moving picture of a dangerous object coming towards them.
Well, remember that the promoter said had people panicked in the audience.
Sure,
there
are
no actual accounts of anybody really panicked. But so there was the first like public movie was, as Brian points out, was the train pulling into the station, right? Because it was neat. Like you're watching a motion picture of this thing happening. And people had like lantern shows and all. There was a lot of stuff prior to that, you know, of watching projected images and stuff and moving projected images using different techniques. But this classic film, somebody went in and took an AI algorithm that was designed, you know, trained on tons and tons of up-res versions of images, and they made a up-res, like a 4K version of this.
All right, pause this before you show any more. All I can picture is smash cut to the Polar Express. Like, that's what I want to believe is what's going to happen.
Just, yeah, Tom Hanks out front. Well, I mean, so I imagine Tom that even as there was, you know, precursors to this would be similar to like when you saw HD for the first time. Mm-hmm. Like when oh God, that's a totally different experience. Like I now can experience media in a totally different way. This was obviously, I mean, it's still famous for a reason, but if you've never seen it normally, I mean, it's this grainy, you know, old ass film thing. So here we go. This is the first time I've seen it in actual 4K.
In 60 frames per second.
Oh jeez.
Oh my God, it looks like a Spanish telenovela. Yeah. Oh my God, it really does.
Yeah.
It is astonishingly real and much smoother than I would have expected. I mean, it's not
The 60 frames per second is more noticeable, I think, than the higher resolution.
Well, you got to go watch the original one, though.
Sure.
Yeah, no, the higher resolution is insane. I mean, just in the reflections alone, it is so noticeably different, and the faces, really, it's like the only thing that you can see that shows that this is archived and not something that you would, you know, shoot now, that it's not like a Westworld thing, is the fact that it still has these stops and starts that are more noticeable mm-hmm. in 60 frames than it would be.
I think that's an artifact of how we're watching it, because when I watched it, so yeah, pull up the original version, because I think they used a different version. So we're looking at the original version, because that was a restored clip we looked on that source one. This is the original version right now. There's all sorts of artifacts on the screen. You're watching a lot of, you know, the dirt and stuff like this, which that whole algorithm got rid of. It's a very shaky frame because the way the film popped around the, you know, inside the sprockets. And it's a very big difference. Now, there is a up-resed or upscaled colorized version out there too. See if you can find it. Right.
Yeah, the big thing, I almost want to say that the motions, the swaying, the way they're walking and all that stuff doesn't look, having just watched that upscaled 4K 60 frames per second version, none of the people look like they're moving anything different or any differently. I would say that the bulk of the transformative effect is that same just that same effect with any kind of frames per second. We're just 28 or 24 frames per second or what looks like, you know, 12 here. Just seems more dreamier and stranger. It's interesting. I'm actually a little bit kind of less impressed now that I see how good the original was.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm blown away. I mean, there are things that I've seen that before. I never noticed that the train was that shiny, and I didn't realize it until I watched this upscale version that, like, now it is so clear that what you are seeing is a reflection. Before, I just probably wrote it off as like artifacting, but just the makeout of the people and the specifics on the train itself. I mean, again, this just looks like something that you would see.
Oh, here's
the intro to Westworld.
Let me send Bryce. I'm going to send you the 4K color version. That was just
so they
the
did
one
both 4K
was...
and color. Yeah. And then get ready for 4K colorized 3D. Also, we replaced everything with computer renderings. Also, the train's now a hoverboard. Get ready. Oh, that's interesting. It's very, very desaturated on the colorized version.
I just found this. I don't know if this is the one. There are
that's
a couple
not,
of colorized versions. Of
yeah.
No, this is the 4K one that was converted. That may be one of the versions. Yeah, because what's happened is they keep improving these algorithms. And one of the ways they train them is they take they'll take a couple shots from different scenes and hand color it and then go tell the algorithm this is what it's supposed to look like. It's colorizing algorithms are getting better, and it's the more data they train with, the better and better they get. And, you know, but just the up-resing and whatnot, I thought was just phenomenal in what it does with, you know, with bad footage, with all sorts of artifacts. That was a big thing there. So,
Here's one with the colors that pop a lot more. Still doesn't. Yeah. Now it's really fairly remarkable. You get this, but again, since it's colorized, we know this is all after the fact. And people sort of making best guesses about what colors different things were.
Well, some of these are algorithmic, where it's not a guess. It's the system trying to guess. And you see flashes of stuff there where it gets a little bit like the computer doesn't know what to do with it. But, you know, it's still, like I said, these things are only going to get better.
Yeah. No, that's remarkable. What do you think in terms of, we know that when it comes to a lot of technologies, there are military and surveillance technologies that are far ahead of what consumer-level technologies are able to do. But then there's original research. And so there's a temptation to believe, like, see, if we're just now seeing this, how long has the government had this? But I wonder whether or not the government does much original invention or just technical doubling down of what academia is figuring out when it comes to, you know, neural networks and AI procedurally generated stuff.
They certainly, the gap used to be much bigger between like government hardware and consumer hardware, but like things like with the smartphone wars and stuff like that, you had a lot of a closing in the gap, but you can still do, if you wanted to make, let's say a, you know, 100 megapixel chip, you know, imaging chip, the government can do that. You know, anybody can do that because you just pay, you build a special fab facility to do that. And things like that are still happening. And as far as neural networks and things like this is, we don't know how many people work for indirectly, but work on government funded projects and black books projects. The budgets for those things are huge, just phenomenally huge. And for the longest time, if you had a computer science degree, your best bet was to go work for, you know, the NSA or some related entity. But now that's changed. What's the gap? I don't know. Like every time we see some breakthrough system come out, like with, you know, voice recognition or deep fakes or stuff, and you read the papers, you find out the biggest limiting factor is being able to afford the amount of computational time, how much money you could spend on developing a better algorithm for that, which means that, you know, there are government researchers and stuff working on projects with millions of dollars of budgets able to outspend your average academic. So I don't know. It could be anything. It could be because sometimes you really just can't throw money at it and solve the problem, you know, and that's the scary thing is we worry about, like, what are the Chinese doing, you know, to some extent with the Russians, or the Russians have a much smaller budget. But like that's why people worry about sort of the AI wars of like what's going to happen between the Chinese and the United States as far as where we're going to these technologies. And the new budget proposal increases the amount of funding for AI research, because that could be, you know, that could be the last, you know, whoever loses that, you know, there are no more winners. Fun times.
Yeah. Way to go, train interstation.
Yeah. Let's stop now. Stop now. But you can't. You can't. So you guys want to do picks?
Yeah, I got a pick for you. Saw this movie. Some of y'all might have heard of it. It's a Korean film called Parasite.
Oh, you finally saw it.
Finally saw it. Where are we on any kind of description of the plot? Are we at a point where I can make a very oblique description of the plot?
They have re-released this movie into theaters, and I think people are still enjoying it for the first time. So I'd say maybe keep it vague.
Yeah, but also you had your opportunities. You had your windows. We ain't gonna hide how Wizard of Oz ends. Guess what? The witch melts. I'm sorry.
This is not about. I think this is not about the ending. This is about the premise, because there was such secrecy around the premise that I was not expecting it to be as straightforward as it was. I thought that it was something that maybe took place in alternate timelines or had some other science fiction component to it. But I was pleasantly thrilled by the general premise of it. And I very much enjoyed the ingenuity of our characters. I liked Parasite a lot. And at some point when I'm legally allowed by way of the decorum of the internet, I would like to announce that I have another title that I think would have gotten me into the theaters to see it immediately upon its initial release if it were called that and not Parasite. But eventually, I'll say it. So at some point when nobody cares to yell at me, just tap me on the shoulder and say, Justin, what would you like Parasite to have been titled?
Justin. Oh. Hey, Justin, I want to know, what would you like Parasite to have been titled?
This scamming ass family. It was all I said repeatedly as the movie was going on. I just kept slapping my hands together and screaming, "This scamming ass family!"
They'll kick you out of the Alamo if we keep doing that.
There was definitely a moment 2/3 of the way through the movie that I'm like, "This is adorable. I should have brought my kids." And then I remembered. It's who the director was and what all of his previous projects had been like. And then I was like, it's probably not going to keep being adorable, is it? And it wasn't.
No.
Because of the Jessica rhyme, you know, was a popular meme. I think you're okay with that title because it's kind of clear there what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, but I thought it was great. I think that if there's going to be the first movie to win Best Picture as a foreign film, it was you know, I don't think it's, to me, far less controversial than, let's say, like The Artist winning, you know, like a silent movie winning best pick. So I thoroughly enjoyed it.
All right. I liked it. I really enjoyed it. I'm a big fan of his. I think he does neat stuff. You know, every time I see one of his movies, I'm delighted by his creativity and where he goes with it. I'm still like, was just in love with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But, you know, I watched Parasite. Like, oh, let me see it. It's like, oh, it's good. Really good. Really liked it.
I got to admit, I would have bet money that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood would have made it. The only reason I could think that it didn't win is because Quentin had already gotten his due and Scorsese had already gotten his due. And, you know, I think it is an inherently political award by, for, mm-hmm. and of Hollywood. And I think that in the war between self-congratulation and not overly giving the same entities the same awards, I think in this case they wanted to do something different.
And remember that the vote, because you vote on, there are five films, and because of the way that works is nobody has to get a majority, you just have to beat somebody else. And so you might have had a lot of people like, they like something else, and Once Upon a Time was their second, but Parasite had enough, no, I really like this and I wanted to go there. And that's sort of the, you know, not that we haven't heard enough about voting already so far, but that's sort of one of the peculiarities of a system like that, where it can be, you know, where you look at like how they try to do other systems, like what's your first choice, second choice, third choice.
Oh, that's I forgot that they do ranked choice voting for this, which I think they're trying out in Maine here in the United States and has been prevalent in Ireland for a very long time.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was more than five. There was nine nominees for Best Picture, which spreads it out even further. But yeah, apparently the betting favorite was 1917. Yeah. So Once Upon a Time, which I thought, I also, you know, but when I saw it, I'm like, all right, well, Quentin's never gotten Best Picture. Mm-hmm. This obviously has a breakout performance where they want to reward Brad Pitt. But I think maybe that's where people wound up making their peace with it, is that Brad Pitt was the guy who basically got to bask in the glory of that movie, whereas they were going to give it to either the big sprawling war epic 1917 or make history with Parasite, which came from behind and won.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Any other picks?
I got a pick. Did I already talk about the book Un-F-Word Yourself? Did we talk about that here on the show?
No, I don't think you talked about it. Yeah.
I think the author's name is Gary John Bishop. I'll get it corrected here momentarily. But Un-F-Word Yourself is fantastic. It's a explanation of just how important so-called self-talk is. You know, the little Gary John Bishop is the guy's name. And if you're able to play just a snippet of his voice, he's got this great Scottish accent. When I first listened to it, I was like, who is this reader? And then I realized it's the author. And as he gets more passionate, it gets better and better. Here, take a listen to how he sounds.
On the quality of your life. Professor Will Hart of the University of Alabama conducted four experiments in which participants either recalled or experienced a positive, negative, or neutral event.
So he goes on, and there are times he gets really passionate, where essentially he talks a lot about Stoicism, you know, a bit of, if you're familiar with Marcus Aurelius stuff, and also the negative self-talk that from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed runs through our head. And he talks about, like, he'll get to a point where he's just like, you're stuck in a loop. What's the F word in point? It's like, if you're not going to be happy, why don't you do this? And so what's been interesting is, as I listen to this and the sequel, Stop Doing That S Word, his voice has become my new self-talk. When I find myself drifting into, oh, but I'm a piece of garbage, I'm a piece of whatever, and he's just like, what are you doing? If you're not here, look above you. It's a beautiful blue sky day. You're walking around on 7 acres. If you can't feel good about this, why are you even doing it? It's been really, really great. I really enjoy it. His stuff is good. It's got that brutal slap of sincerity and honesty to it.
I kind of feel like a little bit of Mike Myers, you know, his like, you know, Scottish father sort of thing, you know. You know, look at the size of his head.
Yeah. Wait, he even says at one point early on in the book, he's like, yes, self-talk matters. I'm not talking about that looking in the mirror and saying I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. I'm just too Scottish for that S word, you know. it's really, really good. I highly recommend it. I like it so much that I'm only halfway done with the second book, and I can tell this is going to be one of those that's just on loop for several relaunches.
I got a pick. Went to the movies over the weekend. There are a lot of films out, and
Motion Pictures is my pick.
I went and actually had a good time with Sonic the Hedgehog, the new video game adaptation of the classic blue hedgehog guy. A couple of things that sort of stood out for me. The action's very good, and I thought it was more fun than Detective Pikachu. I think Detective Pikachu is very, like, a big spectacle, but I think Sonic the Hedgehog really just gets the action better. And Jim Carrey is actually, like, pretty good in this. I think you look at the trailers and you're like, Jim Carrey's not going to be any good because they pick kind of these not great funny moments, but
he's wacky, over the top, annoying Jim Carrey at his rubber faced comedianist.
Yeah, where I think he gets a better shake in the film. The one thing that I didn't catch until the very end is, like, this is a very, like, Americana movie, Sonic the Hedgehog.
Is it like Cannonball Run?
I've not seen Cannonball Run, so no, I don't know.
That's, like, do they go all over America is what I'm asking.
Oh, no. In fact, it is kind of a road trip movie for a very poorly explained reason. But it's I don't know. There are a lot of little things that made me go, oh, this might be, this is really, it's just very weird that they set up Jim Carrey as Dr. Robotnik, and by the end of the movie, you're like, oh, this is definitely like a coastal elite hipster villain trying to take down the country boy who needs to learn the value of staying in the country and not moving to gay San Francisco. Like, all sorts of weird, all sorts of little things like that made me just think about this movie a second time. But I thought it was kind of fun, and I think... as an adult who went and saw it and had a good time, I think kids would enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, largest video game opening of all time.
Holy cow.
It beat out Detective Pikachu.
Bigger than Tomb Raider?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Everything, yeah. But, you know, cheers to the Sonic folks who listened to the online reaction to how terrible the initial CGI was, went and redid it, and it appears like They did the reinvestment on a script that people are resonating with, because it's getting pretty good reviews, and look, it made a ton of money. So,
how rarely is at the story before release, Hollywood responds to angry mob, does exactly what they say, product becomes better. Like, that's not usually what we get.
Well, and it's weird because, you know, if you think of, like, the timeline of that, it's not crazy for a Hollywood production to make a big change at the last minute.
Marvel always plans for reshoots, and they're known for reshoots up until the point of release. They're going to do this, and Marvel's less panicked by that, because they'll go, we like this whole story. They've got this, like, Kevin Feige has this weird, they used to have the whole, the committee that looked at stuff, and now it just goes out there to his own, like, people get notes back with stuff, and this is publicly known stuff. People, like, you know, people who work on Marvel movies and stuff, they will get scripts back with notes and changes, and you don't know where they came from. They're just there, and it's Feige to Feige laterally to somewhere else. But then also, they plan for reshoots. They'll be like, yeah, this is good enough to start production, because they have that window they have to hit. They have to have a May release or whatever. They're going to hit it knowing that, like, okay, yeah, but we've already told our actors, too, this contract. Yeah, if 3 weeks before premiere, we're going to have you in a studio where we recorded lines or shooting extra scenes, this is the way we do it. We know, we make sure the fundamental story is there, but we got to make sure that those little points and things we have to add. And that's smart. But with doing the CGI, and we just saw that with Cats, where they changed it as it was in theaters, mm-hmm. they changed the CGI. Now you can do that, because once you've figured out your main animations and a lot of that other stuff, a lot of time it is sort of just more of reskinning or do some other stuff, which is not trivial, but can be done. And there was a sort of a backlash when they said, oh, we're going to redo Sonic, because some directors are like, ah, you shouldn't listen to the public outcry. I like say, like, yeah, as a general, I think you should go with your instincts. But when your reaction's that strong and you're making a business to make money, if people say your food, we tried the sample and it tastes horrible.
Yeah.
And it, like, you know, Sonic's character design in the movie is good. Like, I just try to imagine scenes of that movie with the old design where he looks like a little kid in a costume and he's got the weird eyes and teeth.
Yeah.
And you know, that would really be bad. I'm glad that they changed. I know, like, last minute and all of the company that did the production on the CG on, you know, shut down afterward, like X, Y, and Z, but I think it was a good call for the movie.
What we don't know too is sometimes there were fights behind the scenes where, let's say, the director said, I wasn't happy, I want you to change this. And the producer's like, no, we already spent this much money on it, we're not going to do it. And they're like, no, we need to do this. Or vice versa. There are fights between them. Like, no, we're going to go this way. And then they get the trailer. And then all of a sudden somebody says, look, I just won the argument, we're going to do the way I asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. Now all of a sudden there's ammunition.
Yeah.
That now all of a sudden everybody agrees. Oh my God! Of course we should redo this. I don't know why. You know, the beat counters.
Fox. Nobody wants a Deadpool movie. Nobody's going to see a Deadpool movie. Deadpool trailer. You know, the fake the previz just leaked to the internet and it blew up the internet. Maybe people want to see a Deadpool movie.
Oh, yeah. Who knew? My God. Jeez, Ryan. I'll tell you what. I'm so glad we were able to get in touch with you. We've been trying to call you for years on this Deadpool. You got to get this thing going.
My pick is Ford versus Ferrari.
Man, I'm so surprised to hear so much good buzz about that movie, because I did not expect much out of it from again, the trailer.
Did you see it?
No. I just keep hearing more and more people saying really good things about it, which...
So my one crit was when the credits came up, when it started, the opening, when the title came up, and I saw that it was Ford v. Ferrari, and like Batman v Superman, I had this sort of like, oh no, we're gonna be fine. We're gonna be fine. Just put that out of your head. Brian, I would say that it is a movie that's about more than the title.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it, and it's, you know, I think it's a great example of, like, Hollywood can make great films that aren't franchised, they don't have superheroes and stuff. And Hollywood can make great stories. Hollywood really can do that. You put them in the hands of somebody who's really capable, like James Mangold did, and the cast they did. And you look, who's, you know, this has been a story that's been, you know, I think a lot of directors have wanted to make forever, but finally got it made. I thought
James
it was very,
Mangold
very well done.
Is the director of Logan, is that right?
Yeah.
Wolverine, Logan, yeah.
310 to Yuma, right? He gets performances and gets two great performances out of two awesome, like, not just actors, these are like movie star performances where they just walk on screen and you can feel their presence. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to walking in. I'm not a crazy car guy, and even I could notice that some of the story has to strain against the realities of the fact that this is a true story, and more specifically that this is a true story about a company that still is in existence and wants the mythology around their company to be a certain thing. But I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was a great night at the movies, and I would encourage everybody to go see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mangold's one of those directors that, like, I wasn't like a fan of like Wolverine. I'm like, is this? And then like, he won. But then once he was able to do, you hear about the behind the scenes. Well, the studio wants this. This is a script they like. Da 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 da. When he got a little more free, when he finally got the free reign for him and Hugh Jackman to go do Logan, the story they wanted to do, and fought to do that, and got like a smaller budget to do that. It's amazing. And that's been, you know, another Fox picture. And it was just sort of, that's the thing I sometimes realize. Sometimes you'll see a movie and you're like, who do you blame? And often it's not the director. It's like they have to work with whatever they have. And you know, he's a guy that seems to just, you know, shine. So
there was a podcast. I'm pretty sure it was Freakonomics. It might have been a radio lab. Pretty sure it was Freakonomics, where they were talking about how Blumhouse pictures work and how they're famously very, very stingy for the most part on their speculative movies. And there was one scene where it was very clear to the director that the only way to get the visceral gut punch is to actually show the needle being stabbed into someone's eye, which means you have to get a life cast, which means you have to get a prosthetic, which, you know, it's a $30,000 shot. And they went back and forth, and Jason Blum was like, you can have this shot if you write the check. And eventually, yeah, in this case, the director had the means, ended up writing the check, and then the movie tanked. And so, yeah, but apparently the director was happy with that shot. But that push-pull is certainly the age-old. Ever since Train pulls into Station, somebody was saying this should be 40K and 60 frames per second, and the producer was like, they can upscale it in post. It'll be fine. Yeah.
Well, just to touch that, but you know, kind of Blumhouse's secret sauce was that obviously they had, like, everybody, a lot of people do super low budgets, but like the Rimchen, like they had a director who had the means. Is they'll get directors who were in director jail, directors who, like, maybe they did a couple big movies with $100 million budgets and they didn't do well, but had been good directors before. And Blumhouse will come in and say, "All right, you got a tiny budget, but I'll give you a freer rein to do what you want to do within that budget, because you know they're Hollywood's undervaluing your talent."
Yeah,
and it's worked out wonderful for them. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.